Welcome to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. Delighted to have you with us. And as usual, we're going to be trying to follow the money. Today, my guest is Alan Roth. He is a financial planner, and he does a monthly financial planning newsletter, and he is a columnist for CBS Money Watch. And I saw his most recent column. That inspired me to call him, even though I've known Alan, I guess, for years now. But Alan, first off, give us some of your bona fides. What do you do?
I'm kind of an oddball. I'm an hourly financial planner, so I basically give advice on building a portfolio, on creating it in a tax-efficient way, on retirement, insurance, etc.
And you don't sell mutual funds or have a product?
Yeah, I don't have a product. In fact, anything I recommend can't pay me.
Right. Anything. Okay. Very good. Very good.
I'm like a doctor, lawyer, or accountant. A fee-for-service financial planner.
Well, I know you wrote a book with a fascinating title, and it was, I believe the title was How a Second Grader Outsmarted Wall Street or Beat Wall Street.
Yeah, exactly. How a Second Grader Beat Wall Street and Don't Time the Market. It came out on March 9th of 09, the day the market bottomed.
Oh, my Lord. And that second grader was your son.
Right.
What was his secret?
His secret was, simplicity, not listening to the news, understanding that you don't put all your eggs in one basket, that it's better to buy things when they're on sale and sell them when they're higher. Just simple common sense that we all seem to suspend once we get older and once money starts meaning too much to us.
So in some ways, ignorance is bliss, huh?
Exactly. I mean, the more you watch the financial media, the more you're likely to make mistakes.
And I showed you in advance the column that I wrote for today, plugging the fact that we're going to be doing this show. And my suggested headline was TSP tip, TSP meaning thrift savings plan, TSP tip, if it feels so good or bad, stop playing with it. And you changed that to pain is a sign you are doing something right. And I get your point. Obviously, you don't want to be that ignorant about it, but you have to be able to withstand some pain, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Anything that feels good, 5 years ago when we were going into the, supposedly the next Great Depression, capitalism was over, get out of stocks before you lose your other half, it really hurt like heck to stay into the market, much less to rebalance and buy more stocks. Then it felt really good to panic and sell and move into the G fund.
Well, I know during in winter, and of course you live in Colorado, so you know what real mountains are, but in the winter, the AAA and other automotive clubs tell you that if you're on ice or snow and you start skidding over the side of the cliff, to turn your wheels in the direction of the skid, and that's easy to say. In practice, it's not so easy.
Yeah, you have to react against your intuition, and basically all of our intuition when it comes to investing is typically wrong.
Run away, huh?
Exactly. Stocks go down, sell. Stocks go up. It was only in 2013 when stocks had hit an all-time high that investors started moving funds back into stocks.
So that's called buying high, right?
That's called selling high and buying, buying high and
selling
low.
Yeah, which is not the way it's supposed to be. Yeah. Well, I know a number of people who, in 2007, 2008, said, I can't stand it any longer. I can't take it. And they took money from the stock, the C, S, and I funds of the Thrift Savings Plan, and moved it into safety, into the G fund. So they sold low, right?
Yeah, exactly. And probably, they are feeling the regret and maybe recently moved back into the CS&I fund.
So then they're buying high.
Right. They're doing the wrong thing. And we are programmed to do the wrong things. Everything that led us to survive as a species fails us when it comes to investing.
Yeah. Well, you pointed out that this Monday was the fifth anniversary of the bull market. Bull is in stock market.
Yes, it was.
Okay.
And a raging bull.
Yeah. Hey, that would be a good movie title. Well, so many people, what about the people who did just the wrong thing, who moved out of the CS&I funds, moved into the G fund, and now they're seeing how high the share prices are for the CS&I fund? Can they do anything?
My advice in general would be that if they panicked and sold in 2008, 2009, they should stay in the G fund because that's probably the best predictor of what they're likely to do the next time. Because the next time stocks plummet, we've had two half-off sales, you know, the internet bubble, the real estate bubble, it's going to be different, and behavior is likely to be similar.
How about the, in the piece you wrote for Money Watch, which I want to quote from in a minute, but how about the L funds of the life cycle funds of the Thrift Savings Plan? Because they rebalance, they become more conservative over time, right?
Yeah, they harness the most powerful force in the universe, inertia.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can stop from tinkering on it, it'll do that rebalancing for you. When stocks plunge, they'll be buying more stocks. When they're going up as they are now, they're going to be selling the stocks to get back to their targets.
And when they sell the stocks, they go into the, in this case, the F fund, the bond fund, or the G fund, the treasury fund, correct?
Yes.
In the TSP.
Correct.
Now you
and the G fund is an incredible deal at the TSP.
Yeah, it's as safe as, or safer than the Rock of Gibraltar nowadays.
Yeah, it pays as much as the F fund. And it's 100% backed by the U.S. Treasury versus the F fund, which is only 68%. And then it has no interest rate risk, meaning that if, and it's not a given, interest rates rise this year, the F fund's going to lose value, the G fund won't.
We're talking about the raging bull market, and your piece for Money Watch, you said, I believe, that over the last 5 years, the S&P 500, which is the top 500 funds in the U.S., and the one that the C fund tracks, is up 177.6%, and that's only part of the story.
Yeah, the index itself is only the appreciation. It doesn't include the return that comes from dividends, and obviously the S&P 500, for all practical purposes, are only the 500 largest stocks in the country. So the equivalent of the total market over the three-year period was up by more than tripled, up 221.8%. That would be the equivalent of the C and the S fund, 75% C, 25% S.
That's amazing. Well, for once, I did something right because I did nothing. I in my 401k, I stayed in the sort of the life cycle version of our 401k, and every time I'd get my statement, there was no change. The only addition was the contribution that I put into it. We don't get a match for ours, but it just stayed the same old amount for seemingly forever. And then one day I opened it and I couldn't believe my eyes.
Yeah, capitalism is alive and well.
Going good. Now it was interesting. You mentioned the two bubbles we had, the internet bubble, and I got caught up in that. I had left the Washington Post for an internet company, and we went gangbusters for a year, and then suddenly it all fell apart, and nobody could believe it. You know, people were begging to be paid in stock rather than money. It was that we were all caught up in that euphoria, and we learned a lesson. But real estate was the old, the standby, the one that's always safe, never has a bad day. And for years in the late 1990s and early 2000s, there was a very strong lobby here in Washington that was pushing for a REIT, a real estate investment trust fund. And the idea was that real estate can never go down, and particularly commercial real estate, which is primarily what REITs were. And they lobbied very hard with the Congress and with the media to get an R fund established in the Thrift Savings Plan. And the TSP officials consistently argued that people already have an exposure to REITs, to real estate in their CS and I funds, and that they didn't want to set up a targeted fund of one particular industry or unit like that because it was too risky. So it turns out that was not a bad move, huh?
Yeah, very good. And typically, in fact, predictably, people will lobby to add something to the TSP fund on what has performed well, which is exactly buying high.
Yeah, that's true. And also, too, particularly with the TSP, and the pressure comes from Congress and from the industry, but there are a lot of people who want the TSP to have a socially conscious fund, or a gold fund would be a good example there. They pushed for that for years.
Yeah, when gold was hitting an all-time high, and you know, gold could never go down in price, real estate can never go down in price, it's a new age economy, cash flow no longer matters, just put a .com behind your name. You know, these new paradigms will kill us. And by the way, the new paradigm 5 years ago was capitalism was dead.
That's right. I think I saw it on the front page of a cover of a magazine.
So Alan, you've got to ignore those new paradigms. You know, neither good times nor bad times last forever, but yet we extrapolate the recent past into the future.
Yeah, and someone once said to me that investing was a lot like driving across country using only your rearview mirror. That it's really the only thing we have, and that's not necessarily a very good tool.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I happen to think I'm brilliant at predicting the past.
Exactly.
My you know, core competency is that I know that I don't know the future, and we invest, you know, based on, you know, certain belief systems and the like.
Yeah. Well, we need to take a short break here. I'm talking with Alan Roth from CBS Money Watch, and we'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com. Okay, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Alan Roth. He's a columnist for CBS Money Watch, and he does financial planning on as you'd go in to see your doctor for a fee rather than selling people mutual funds or whatnot. Alan, and his book is How a Second Grader, what is it called? How a Second Grader Beat Wall Street?
That's it, exactly.
Okay, and it is available, I guess you can Google it and get it, huh?
Yeah, it's on Amazon. It's 5 years old.
And the second grader was your son, who was 8 at the time. And you said in the first segment of the show that one reason he was such a good investor was that he wasn't emotional about it. Money didn't mean a whole lot to him, and he probably did not watch those 24/7 cable shows about how good or badly the market is doing. He just was a kid.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you think of it, money is stored energy that allows us to do what we want with our lives. And when the market plunges, it causes a great deal of pain as that energy evaporates, and it makes us do the wrong things. But when you're 8 years old, money doesn't mean a thing to you. And it's pretty simple to follow common sense.
Yeah, which is maybe we get less of it as we get older. Used to know a financial planner, and in his office, he had a painting, a chart, sort of a horizontal thing, and it was looked like a stock market reaction thing, which in fact it was. And he showed me this little blip on the map or the chart, and that was the Great Depression. But in the scheme of things, I mean, it was a horrible time. Hope we never experience anything like it again. But it was a blip in the market, and I know you were talking once about during this 5 year period of recovery, our 5 year bull market, that there was still so much bad news.
Yeah, I graphed the total U.S. stock market, the combination of the C and the S funds, and it's amazing how, you know, consistently, you know, stocks rose during that period without a bear market. But yet, I looked at some of the headlines during that period, and the most recent being February 3rd. You know, stocks, the Dow plummets 1,200 points. You know, what's happening in the market can be explained by 1928, 1929 with this humongous plunge coming.
Mm-hmm.
And if you looked at that, you know, market plunge, it was barely a blip in even the 5 years, much less a longer period of time.
Yeah, I think somebody wrote a book one time and said, been down so long, looks like up to me, but you can reverse that. And if you're at a record high or near record high, you can take a 1,200-point hit.
Yeah, and you know, 1,200 points sounds huge, but in a percentage terms, it was very small. And, of course, that was on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is merely 30 stocks.
Have you ever known anybody who could time the market?
Yeah, I think almost all investors can time the market incredibly poorly.
Yeah, okay. I interviewed John Bogle one time, the founder of the Vanguard index funds, and you know, the guru of it all. And he said he couldn't time the market. He'd never met anybody that could time the market. And I thought, well, that's and based on what you say, that chances are people who think they're timing the market are not doing so well.
Yeah, and you know, there are many people that believe that they're timing the market incredibly well, but the facts show otherwise. And I just an example of timing, if your timing were absolutely terrible and you bought into a total stock index fund on October 9th of 07, which was the pre-crash high, and you did nothing, you would be up 5.75% today.
Okay. All right. But as it was, the people who kept rolling along did much better.
Yes, and those that rebalanced. And you can rebalance two ways, either manually or through the life cycle funds.
I had a friend, a colleague, and when he retired, he had his 401k plan was almost exactly the amount, and it was almost exactly the same that I had. And we, during the 90s, we had a good time. We'd go in and look at the spreadsheets every day, and we were trying to decide whether we were going to buy a house at the beach or in the mountains. And, you know, the good times were rolling. You couldn't lose money. He left, and I guess he got bored, and he took a course in investing, how to invest. And it involved two computers, not one but two. And I think, I never saw it, but someone told me that it involved, there were arrows in the program that you bought, and that when the arrows were green and pointing up, you bought a certain thing, and when they were red and pointing down, you sold. He went to several conferences, bought this expensive equipment, and within 2 years was absolutely penniless. He lost everything he had in his 401k. Does that surprise you?
No, it doesn't surprise me. In fact, I investigated, and I happen to know the outfit that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, common sense is not all that common when it comes to investing. You know, this outfit, you know, had been doing this for a while, and if it actually worked, they would have published data on it working, or better yet, you know, they would have sold the software to a hedge fund for billions of dollars instead of trying to pitch it, you know, for a $1,000 a year subscription type of thing.
Well, that's what I thought. If I've got a guaranteed money-making machine, I will keep it, go into my dark basement, which I don't have, and I'd make an awful lot of money, and then, as you said, sell it for billions of dollars.
If I knew how to beat the market, Mike, I would have my plane come out, pick you up, and fly you to my house in Aspen.
Yes, exactly.
I wouldn't tell you how I'm doing it.
Yeah, well, you didn't do it. When somebody comes into your office, what do they bring? What kind of documents do they bring? What material do you have to work with?
Well, I make it kind of difficult for clients to come in. They've got to first fill out a profile, so it gives me kind of a background of you know, what they have, what they've been doing, you know, what their goals are. And probably 80-90% of my clients are out of state.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'll take a look at their investment portfolio versus their goals, you know, the allocation, whether they're in inexpensive funds, or are they sitting there in cash earning nothing, which is a guaranteed loss in real terms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those sorts of things. And every client has, you know, very different circumstances.
Do you think people are good at figuring themselves out? I mean, if you ask if they're conservative or nervous, do you think people realize what they are?
No, I think, you know, when markets are at an all-time high as they are now, we think we can take far more risk.
Yeah.
When markets plunge, we think we can't take risk. And, you know, being consistent is the most important. And no, the way we feel about risk, it's not stable over time.
We're going to take a short break here, talking with Alan Roth from CBS Money Watch. We'll be back in a minute. All right, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. We're glad to have you with us, and I'm talking today with Alan Roth. He's a columnist with CBS Money Watch. And I think the story of how we met is interesting. I made some reference in a column to Dare to Be Dull, and you called me, I believe, and said, very, very nice and everything, but you said, I own that. That's my slogan. And I had picked it up from a friend who was a reporter for the New York Times, and he was talking about reporting science, and he said, to do it right, you have to dare to be dull, because otherwise you blow things up, and it's not only not true, but it's unrecognizable to the researchers, and we sort of bonded over that.
Yeah, an attorney had heard you on the radio and said I should send you an email to cease and desist. And only I listened to it, and I said, boy, are you using that in the right way.
Good.
Love this guy.
Good, yeah. Well, my friend was a science writer, and we were talking about the difficulties of it, and he said something would happen. Scientists would work 5 years on a project, and then they'd issue their research paper, and reporters had 15 minutes to digest it. And so they boiled it down to its simplest level and then blew it up. And he said by the time you saw it in the paper, or even worse, heard it on television, it was unrecognizable to the scientists who had done the research. So his motto was dare to be dull. That's how it came out. Yeah. Let me ask you about the different funds in the Thrift Savings Plan. The C Fund is the 500 largest companies, easy to track. The S Fund is the rest of the U.S. market, something like, 4,500?
Roughly, yeah. It's the Wilshire 4,500.
Okay, and then the I Fund is an international stock index fund. And you think people should have some of those in their portfolio at all times?
Well, I think people that are going to, invest in global capitalism need to be in there at all times. People that move in and out, panic and greed, probably don't belong there in the first place.
Okay, now what about, you've been talking about balancing, rebalancing and whatnot. These life cycle funds that the government has, and many, Vanguard has them, Fidelity, I guess every major investment house has them. You look at it, particularly if you're a government worker, you don't look at it. Your target date is not the date you're going to retire, as I understand it. The target date is the day you're going to start withdrawing money from that account. So if you're a federal worker, particularly under the old civil service retirement system, you have a good annuity. You may have savings. You may have got an annual leave payment for your first year. Many people can do very well without tapping the TSP until they have to at age, I guess it's 70 and a half, something like that. What do you think of target funds? What do you think of the TSP's target funds?
I love them. They're ultra low cost, and they harness that inertia. In other words, I'm a believer that being consistent on an asset allocation is more important than getting it right in the first place. So they will own U.S. international stocks, bonds, and the G fund, and they'll do that rebalancing for you and get slightly more conservative as time passes on.
Okay, and that's the way it works. If you're in the 2040 fund now, the assumption is, again, that's not that you're going to retire in 2040, but that's when you're going to start taking money out of the account. And as it draws closer to 2040 or 2030 or 2020, the fund automatically rebalances and gets a little bit more conservative. Is that the way they work?
Exactly. And when you hit that target date, it doesn't mean it's all going to be in the G fund.
Right.
Because you're only starting to spend that money. It's not that you need it all on that date.
Well, I know you're a great one about protecting yourself against inflation. So this is why you don't want people exclusively in the G fund, correct?
Yeah. There are lots of people that come to me with millions of dollars in cash earning, 0.01%. And the analogy that I do is that they say if you put a frog in boiling water, it'll jump right out. But if you put it in room, temperature and slowly heat it up, it'll boil to death.
Yeah.
That's what cash is. It feels good when markets plunge, but you're guaranteed in 20 years to be able to buy less than half the stuff you can buy today.
Well, I've never understood, and they call them the gold bugs, the people who wanted the Thrift Savings Plan to offer a precious metals fund, which would be gold and platinum, and there were some who demanded that it be limited to gold. And I've never quite understood how that's going to work if there is a national disaster or whatnot. Do you take a bar of gold down to the 7-Eleven and get cigarettes and beer, or do you, how that would work in a portfolio?
Yeah, gold has a long, long history of keeping up with inflation and having a zero real return. And I happen to totally agree with you that if the U.S. government goes out of business, I'm not going to be showing up at the grocery store buying milk and eggs with my gold coins.
Or worse yet, with a certificate that somebody is holding the gold for you in their vaults, correct?
Right.
I've never investigated those kinds of things. Has anyone ever challenged that? the fact that you're buying certificates and they're holding, they've got physical gold for you, but they have it.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest ETF in the country about a year and a half ago was GLD, the iShares Gold Fund. Now, I believe everything is legit, that they were putting away, you know, they were buying that gold bullion and putting it away. But, you know, clearly, you know, if we got into a disaster, they're not going to ship you the gold.
Yeah. That's a case where I would rather have it in a coffee can buried in my backyard.
And don't tell anyone.
Exactly.
Buried it in your backyard.
Very good. Well, Alan, kind of sum it up here. Emotion is bad in investing, correct?
Yeah, you can't ignore emotion, but you have to learn to recognize it. And if you're doing something that feels good, that's a bad sign. And if it hurts, and right now it hurts to sell stocks and move into bonds or even the G fund, but especially bonds, because there's this belief, which I think is false, that interest rates have to go up. So pain is a likely gain.
Right. And you're not, I know you don't predict the stock market, but do you think that the everybody, each month they wait to see what the chairman of the Fed is going to do, and there's all the speculation about interest rates go up. What if they do go up? I mean, is that the end of the world?
Well, you know, the Fed controls short-term rates. They're trying to influence long-term rates with quantitative easing. You know, to the extent that, you know, they're successful, I don't think that it's having a material impact. And we really don't know what rates are going to do. And the top economists have forecasted the direction of rates about 30% of the time, far less than a coin flip.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like the employment figures that come out. They come out, everybody reacts. It's either good or bad, or a sign things are improving or getting worse. And then they're nearly always corrected at the later in the month. So we're
right. And whether, you know, the good news or bad news, the market goes up or down, you know, the media always tries to explain why the market does what it does. On any given day, we have no clue why the market does what it does.
I love it. Thank you very much. Oh, and one other thing. Would you like to predict where the market's going?
I predict that it's very, very unlikely that the next 5 years are going to be anywhere near as good as the last five. That's as far as I'm going.
Very good. Okay, Alan Roth, CBS Money Watch, thank you very much. Alan, would you give your would you mind giving your email address? I mean, do you want people to contact you?
Oh, sure. It's my initials, AR, for Alan Roth, at daretobedull.com.
AR at daretobedull.com. Very good. Thank you, sir. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you. Stay tuned. We're going to be talking with the folks from the Federal Times. Be right back. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Nicole Johnson, the Federal Times. She specializes in IT, and she has this wonderful ability to explain it in English, which is much appreciated by people like me. Nicole, you had some kind of IT event this week?
Yeah, actually, one IT-related and another where IT actually came up at the event. This was an FMA training conference. And Director Archuleta from OPM, she kicked the event off on Tuesday morning, and gave some hints as to what would be included in an OPM IT strategy that was released. And that has since come out, and it was interesting to see all of the different reforms. This was, a promise she had made during her confirmation hearing, that within the first 100 days of her being in office, she would lay out plans to, reform the way that that OPM, buys, manages, and delivers services to federal employees, retirees as well.
Was anything said about the security clearance process?
It was mentioned in there, as was a host of processes they had. They didn't give specific details for how they would reform that, but did mention that as a process that they would be looking into. Of course, the claims processing was a huge one. And some of the points they listed in there is looking at developing requirements for an electronic requirement retirement application for employees who are planning to retire, and making available to them more accurate counseling on how to do that, as well as you know, making more retirement data readily available and kind of cross-referencing that with HR data, data from payroll systems, so that agencies can do better workforce planning as well, and also making sure that the people who are processing these claims have the right tools that they need, whether it's, you know, collaboration tools, to chat, or different things to help them to better coordinate amongst each other, as well as a case management tracking system that OPM mentioned that would help them to better track how far along they've come with processing a certain case, what the status is, and what's left to be done. So there was a host of things listed in there.
I would think that, I mean, that's something that's of concern to everybody, because if you eventually retire from the U.S. government someday, you want to get a check, and you want to get a full retirement check as soon as possible. And right now, it's not working that way. We've heard anecdotally people who had to wait, who got 40% of their estimated annuity, and some of them waited as long as a year to get a full annuity.
You're absolutely right. And these are stories that we've been writing about for years now, of those types of challenges and employees having to get partial annuities as, you know, OPM works out the processing on their end. And it was interesting to hear from some of the union groups on, you know, what their thoughts on OPM's IT strategy. And, you know, they point out exactly the point you mentioned, that in some cases you have federal retirees who are waiting months. I've even heard years to receive their full annuities. So it's one of those where you're happy to see that there is a plan in place to address that, but a lot of this hinges on having the money in place to do it. It's one thing to say we're going to modernize all of these systems to improve these processes, but you don't do that for free.
I'm always interested in the great expectations that Hollywood and TV raise in the computer world. And there are a couple of crime shows, the names escape me, but I do watch them. And whenever they want to track down somebody, they say, Nicole, get me everything you have on John Smith. And within five keyboard strokes, she knows where he lives, his record, what he likes to eat, his military service. And it doesn't work that way in real life, does it?
Well, not that way in the federal government, especially because you have information on employees that are stored away in file cabinets on paper, but then you have some cases where data is stored electronically. So especially for federal employees who, you know, are not recent hires or, you know, hired anywhere during the 2000s, they're going to be in a situation where a lot of their data is in multiple places. And paper, electronic as well. So collecting the information that you need to do processing in an efficient manner is slowed down because all the information is not digital.
You know, this problem has been around forever, irregardless of what administration it is. And I remember in one of these cyclical things, they found that there was tremendous delay in processing, and it was mostly paper in those days. But they found that federal agencies were waiting until the end of the month to send over all of the retirement applications to OPM. So in theory, you could retire on the 31st or the 1st, and the agency would hold your application until it got the last one for that month and then send them over en masse. And that was creating an automatic 30-day delay for some people.
Yeah, and I mean, there's also, you mentioned creating the delay. I know there were some concerns voiced on the side of OPM, the fact that they had, you know, increased work hours and really tried to staff up to help with the backlog. But then the sequester came along, and of course that affected, you know, timetables and their ability to process those claims. So you're exactly right. There are a lot of different factors that play into why, you know, that this process isn't as smooth as it should be.
Well, and they have the politicians enact a law and then leave it to the federal agencies to work out how it's going to work. And that's why the expression, the devil's in the details, that's why it exists. And sometimes Congress has these different priorities, Congress and the White House during the Clinton years. I guess, a little before your time on the beat, but during the Clinton years, the president decided to downsize the government by something like 272,000 people, something like that. And they contracted out a lot of things, including a lot of the HR work. They consolidated it and contracted it out. And the investigations, which, you know, have come to light in the wake of Robert Snowden and these other people, but they contracted that out, and everybody was relatively happy with it until it came to light that some of these contractors weren't doing their job. So and then they toss it back into the government, but don't give them the money to carry it out.
You're absolutely right, and that comes down to also looking at positions that are inherently governmental, and what should the government be doing? And what should contractors not be doing? But you're exactly right. There was a big move to outsource a lot of that work, and now you're left looking around at the workforce that you have and saying, well, gosh, we don't have the skill sets that we need to do X. IT being one of them, looking at what skill sets do we have in-house to do what we need, and a lot of agencies are finding that they're falling short and not able to adequately plan for what their needs are going to be down the road.
Well, there was another conference, an IT conference, Tuesday, at which they featured, I think I said Robert earlier, Edward Snowden, the American who's now resident in Moscow, the former NSA employee and contractor. And he had a Skype conference, and they said there were 3,000 of these extremely high-tech people, Austin being the perfect venue for it. And did you hear anything about that? I did talk to one person.
Yeah, it was South by Southwest, and I actually have a colleague who covers. I'm now back to doing more civilian type work, but mm-hmm. she tuned into that. I really didn't have a chance to tune in, but at this point, you know, anything that he says, you have people waiting, and it's gold. They want to know, you know, what he has to say about certain topics, especially because you're not, you know, in some sense getting. The full story, as someone would like it to be, from the government side. So, no, I heard exactly the same thing, that he created quite a buzz with what he had to say there.
Yeah, and I talked to somebody who talked to somebody, so this is third hand, if you will. But they said that they were actually, the term they used, that they were underwhelmed by it all, and that they didn't think he made a very good presentation. And a number of people actually got up and left the room, not because they were angry, but just in boredom.
And I think because this is something that has been, it really has been drawn out.
Yeah.
We've heard, you know, okay, so in drips and drabs, you know, coming from the press about, you know, what NSA has been doing in terms of their data collection practices. We've, you know, heard him clarify the fact that he says he did not steal employees' passwords. And, you know, the fact that he really, you know, doesn't seem remorseful for what he did. He really has no regrets about that.
Okay. Nicole, we need to take a short break here on Federal News Radio. We'll be back after this. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Nicole Johnson. Nicole, before we leave the Edward Snowden thing, he spoke at the, what did you call that conference?
South by Southwest.
Right, and that's a big deal in the computer IT world.
Absolutely. It's a conference that draws a lot of people. You have people, you know, in the entertainment world who are interested mm-hmm. in this. You have people in the press who are interested in this. But you know, in terms of what you were asking about, you know, Snowden and his appearance there, you know, really the gist of, you know, what came out of it, and like he said before, is that, you know, he felt that what he did in terms of, you know, releasing, you know, information about the practices of the National Security Agency was warranted. Because, you know, those practices were impeding on, you know, constitutional rights of citizens and violating those rights. And so that's why he saw the need to do what he did. But, you mentioned it being underwhelming, but at this point, you know, what new, you know, information besides what he's, you know, leaking to the press is going to come out of you know, something like this. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, that's true. And it'll be interesting to see how the media covers it too. What they have as the takeaway headline in this thing. You went to the Federal Managers Association conference today. In fact, you spoke there, did you not?
I was at the conference, sitting in the audience.
Okay.
Listening to some of the guest speakers there, and one that was really interesting and you know drew a lot of praises from the managers in the audience was the chief human capital officer at the Agriculture Department, and he really went over some efforts that they implemented to ensure that they were measuring their progress. I think it's one thing for an agency to say, okay, here's this administration initiative, you know, we're going to do XYZ, and then you never really hear anything about how they're doing or what their progress has been. And at the Agriculture Department, there are monthly reports that come out of their human resource office, and they create these milestones and metrics that in some cases are based on the employee viewpoint survey to really track how well are our managers doing against these goals that we set, one of them being telework. So they're looking at, you know, how many employees are eligible to telework, how many are actually teleworking. How well are we doing in hiring people with disabilities? How well are we doing in hiring veterans, as well as looking at employee engagement? You know, are you providing resources, tools, trainings for your employees to be involved in? As well as one I thought was interesting was the hiring process itself. How many days, how long does it take for us to onboard someone? I know at one point they mentioned they had got, I think last year it was, they had got below that 80-day time frame. That number has recently crept back up, and so that's something that they'll be tackling at looking at making sure that, you know, they're hiring people, onboarding them within a reasonable time frame.
And, you know, I can see the political blowback from that, because they're going to hire a bad character or a traitor or a terrorist or something, and then they'll find out that he was processed in, quote, only 30 days, and they'll be demanding somebody's scalp for that.
I know, exactly, right? We want what we want, and we want it now, and then when something goes wrong, we're looking to, you know, see who is to blame for that.
Yeah, I thought it was amusing when the people were complaining about the private contractor, because some of them are the same ones that applauded that privatization 15 years ago.
Yeah.
You mentioned something about the hiring times and whatnot, and I wonder if, I mean, I don't have the experience in the private sector, but I wonder if the government is that much different from the private sector in hiring times. You know, there's always the rap that it takes forever in the government and red tape and you don't hear from them, but I wonder if anybody's compared that to a big corporation.
That's an interesting point you mentioned. I'm trying to think back to, you know, what I may have heard from different large corporations, but it sounds like their processes are a lot smoother because there isn't as much red tape for bringing people on board, and it's easier to do that not only once the employee is hired, but just kind of getting them acclimated, whether it's, you know, getting them the technology they need to get on the job, making sure they're already, you know, have some sense of what their work's going to be prior to day one, so that they're not sitting around not able to do anything once they're on the job.
Well, of course, Washington is a town full of politicians, and they say X-class presidents. It's a city of X-class presidents. But one of the things people sometimes do to make a point is exaggerate. And so I wondered about the hiring time, because I remember during the Clinton administration's downsizing, the director of OPM had a number of events where he showed the silliness of the way that government did things, and he held up his form, I think it's 171 it was called, but it was the standard application form. And he was a tall guy. He was 6'2", 6'3", and he held the form up, and it dragged, it reached from wherever they were to the outskirts of Hyattsville, practically. I mean, it was really a silly-looking document. And so I called OPM and asked and got a copy of the standard 171, and it was very short. And I compared it to the Washington Post's, and the Post was longer than the government form. And when I asked somebody what they were doing, they said, oh, he showed his form. And he had been in and out of government and moved around, so he had attachments. But it wasn't a very fair way to present the thing. And they wanted to make the government look silly, and it did.
Yeah, and, you know, I think, you know, back to one of the points you mentioned is, you know, whenever there is an agency who, you know, may be required to adhere to some, you know...
mandate or something.
Some mandate,
yeah.
That they want to make their point known on, you know, why this will be a challenge for us, why we might not be able to meet the, you know, deadlines that have been set for us, and kind of really create this big case, you know, to I guess gain sympathy in a way, but you know, in some cases there are truths to those, you know, whether they're testifying at a hearing or showing that, hey, you know, whatever mandate
yeah.
we've been required to do, this is going to be a challenge for us.
The OMG moment. We got about 2 minutes left here. I wanted to ask you. You said the magic words telework, and Frank Wolf, Republican from Virginia, is retiring this year from Congress after many, many years, and he's really kind of the godfather of teleworking. He got it rolling, and we noticed here in Washington and all up and down the East Coast, even in the Deep South, miserable winter. Tougher than usual all over. Government shut down a number of times,
yes.
and the teleworkers continued to work. And there was some unhappiness on the part of a few of them, not the majority by far, but some of them were unhappy that they had to work when their regular commuter colleagues got the day off. You hear anything about that?
I haven't heard about that specifically, but I know in working with some of the feds who were at work or on call
yeah.
during the snowstorm answering my questions as their bosses were off or weren't able to come into the office or do what they usually do remotely, there is a little envy in you know, them having to still work. But the whole point of telework is, you know, regardless of where you are,
yep.
being able to get your work done.
Well, life isn't fair. You get the last word. Thank you, Nicole Johnson, for being here. Thanks, Lauren Larson, for producing the show. We'll see you next week. Have a good week.